We're beginning in volume one, and if you take any look at volume one, you will see there are no dates on most of it. That's because Louisa was already 20 years into her very special relationship with God before her spiritual director, Father Gennaro Di Gennaro, asked her to write it down. It took them 20 years to realise that this was something absolutely, completely astonishing. I can't imagine that it should take anybody 20 years. I thought it would take anybody 5 minutes to know that this is just not your usual stuff. It took them 20 years to tell her to write anything down. So the problem that Louisa has in the first volume is if somebody asked me to write what has been happening to me for the past 20 years. Would you find that a problem? Yeah, she found it a problem as well. And she needed an enormous amount of help from the Lord. Now, one of her problems is that she had no schooling at all. By comparison with our schooling, she would have had babies and senior infants in primary school. That's before you learn your ABC and before you learn how to read. That's all she got. And this extraordinary relationship with God put her giving us the highest possible mystical theology. She never learned theology, let alone mystical theology. She didn't learn how to read or write. Everything comes from the Lord. So you're going to hear her saying time out of number that she finds this very difficult. So would I if I hadn't learned how to read or write, would you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I want you to understand this from her angle. But in the past 20 years, she's going to be trying to tell you that extraordinary things have happened to her. I don't know if you've studied spirituality, but in the 16th century, St. John of the Cross was considered the, well, it's not only in the 16th century, but since then, he has been considered the top, the pinnacle. And if you've read the books of John of the Cross, you'd realise, because he was just an incredible writer and poet and theologian and everything. It's just pure joy reading his stuff. But he describes a soul coming slowly, slowly, slowly into union with God. And that this is the pinnacle of your experience on the earth. Well, by the time Louisa gets to write this, she's had three unions with God. The one that John of the Cross talks about. And then afterwards, Jesus took her to heaven, where she was married to the Blessed Trinity in heaven. And then the third one was when she was married to the Crucified. And the second two marriages you will not find in any other life ever. Ever. This is completely unique. So coming to this, you are dealing with a person who has a completely unique relationship with God. Now, what she's going to do here is she's going to talk to the Lord about what she's been asked to do. So it's also a prayer. And if you read this prayerfully, you will get an enormous amount out of it. In the first few years, she's going to leave a lot out. And she's going to need an enormous amount of pressure put on her, both by the priest and by the Lord, to tell more. So Louisa has to have an enormous amount of pressure put on her. And you will even be up to volume 9 or 10 before she will even want to give some of the details that has actually happened, because it's so private. It's so private. It's like someone demanding of you the details of the privacy of your marriage. Now, if you don't have a resistance to it, you're not human. Okay, there are some things are just too private to tell anybody. And this is the demand that's being made on Louisa, that she should tell the most intimate and the most private things of her life. And so for her, it is enormous suffering, just enormous suffering. Okay, so she says, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, out of pure obedience, I want to write. It's only because it's been put on her. You know, O Lord, the sacrifice that it costs me, it costs her everything, such that I would submit myself to 1,000 deaths rather than write one single line of the things that have passed between me and you. because this is utterly private. "Oh my God, my nature trembles," she said. "It feels crushed and almost undone at the mere thought of it. Please give me strength, O life of my life, that I may do this holy obedience. You who have given inspiration to the confessor, give me the grace to be able to execute what you have commanded of me." As we go on in these writings, Jesus will tell Louisa that he wants her an exact copy of himself. Now, if that isn't a tall order, you've never heard one. Because after all, he was divine as well as human. And he wants her an exact copy of himself. And if you go to the gospel, you will find that the thing that literally Jesus was known for was his obedience. "I only do what my Father tells me to do. I only say what my Father tells me to say. I only reveal what my Father tells me to reveal. The Father and I are one." And it goes on and on and on. And finally, in John 14:31, he says, "I want the world to know that I love the Father, and therefore I do exactly what my Father tells me." Now, one of the things that was demanded of Louisa was not heroic obedience. Heroic obedience is fine. You have to go way beyond that. Something that cost her life. And we'll meet these things as we go along. And so the obedience of Jesus in his life is shown in her life right from the very beginning of these volumes. And that obedience is very important for any one of us who's taking the journey into divine will. Because if we do not have obedience to God's will and obedience to God's word and obedience to the Ten Commandments, go home, you're not part of divine will. And if it doesn't cost you to obey God every now and then you haven't read the rules. It's only when somebody's will crosses yours that you realise that you have to lay down your will in order to do God's will. And so anybody entering the journey of divine will, because that's what it is, it's not a devotion, it's a journey, it's an adventure, it's wonderful, it's frightening as well. Anyone entering into this, your motto has to be, "Not my will, but thine be done." Not my will, but thine be done. And if the Lord sees that you get serious about it, what he will do is he will allow people to cross you without warning and in a completely irrational manner as well to see, will you give in? And it's only when somebody crosses you that you realise how hard it is sometimes to actually just let go. And the issue is simply letting go to let God have his way. That's all. That's what the issue is. So you'll hear an awful lot more about this if you hang in. So she says that the priest received an inspiration to give her the obedience. So she says, "You give me the grace." That is the divine ability to do it. That's what grace is here. "O Jesus, O spouse, O my strength," she said, "to you I rise, to you I come, into your arms I introduce myself, I abandon myself and I rest." Okay. You see, throughout these writings, I'm going to have to give you two scriptures over and over and over and over and over again. John 15:5 is the first one. Jesus said, "Without me, you can do nothing." I presume you've proved that one. And the corollary to that is Philippians 4:13. "I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength." Now, those two scriptures will keep you going for at least 12 chapters. When you witness Louisa going through this extraordinary death to self. This is very easy to read about in a book. It's actually very difficult to do. So I can't do it by myself. "Without your help, I'm sure I will not have the strength to do this obedience that costs me so much. I will let myself be defeated by the enemy, and I also fear being crushed by you justly because of my disobedience." So she says, I'm caught between, you know, the human will that doesn't want to do it and the divine will that wants to impose it. And that's where we're at in this thing. "Oh, please look me over and over again, O holy spouse, in these arms of yours. See how much darkness surrounds me. It is so thick as to allow not even one atom of light to enter my soul. Now, that darkness is that she's on her own. There's nobody else on this journey with her. And it took the priest 10 years to think that it was important enough to write it down. I find that, that's one of the things I find fascinating. Okay. She said, "Oh, my mystical son, Jesus." Now, the son throughout the 36 volumes is taken as the symbol of Christ. And the reason is that the sun is the source of light, heat, growth, beauty, colour, and all the rest of it. And you'll begin to appreciate as you go through these writings that when the ancient peoples worshipped the sun, they were only partially wrong. They weren't fully wrong, because the sun was the source of all of this. They were just like an infant at the breast, sucking away at the mother's breast. And then the infant has to find out, oh, there's a face behind the food. And one of the most wonderful moments for a mother is when the little finger comes up to find out, yeah, there's a face up there. There's a person behind the food. Now, that was the revelation that had to be made to the ancient world. And Moses was the person used by God to bring that revelation to Egypt, that behind Ra, the sun god, there was God, you know. And then when you come to the New Testament and you come to the incarnation, there is the Son of God. Okay, so throughout these writings, Jesus calls Jesus the sun of her life, the source of everything, the source of light and all the rest of it. And you'll find in these very early writings expressions that come out of the later writings that are actually put here. But if you look at Psalm 36:9, "Lord, in your light we see light." And that's what she's saying. I have darkness all around me. I have no help. But if you come and assist me, then in your light we see light. Okay. Also, if you go to Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 to 2, light was the very first thing that was created on the earth. Let there be light. Okay. So, O eternal sun, unleash another ray of light into the intimate part of my heart and purify it of the mud in which it lies. Now, mud in these writings is anything to do with the earth and the pulling down, the weakness of the human will and all the rest of it. Ignite it and consume it with your love. Now, she's saying here that in order for us to be able to come into this union with God, and in order for the divine will to be able to take over, the Lord has to do an absolutely unbelievable amount of purification in us. We think we're grand until he gets at us and then he realises, no, 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 I've got to do this and this and this and this. And it keeps going all your life. If he has finished purifying you by the time you die, you're darn lucky. He says in the higher volumes, he says 9 out of 10 people go to purgatory. 9 out of 10. That means the vast majority of the human race are not ready for heaven, no matter how good they are. And they're his own words, they're not mine. Because in this commentary, I won't give you my words, I'll only give you his. So she asks for this purification to enable her to see. So consume it in your love so that my heart, which more than everything has experienced the sweetness of your love, may manifest them clearly to the one who is obliged, I'm obliged to do so. In other words, give me the ability to tell the priest. He's the one I'm obliged to tell. That's just saying, I need your help. Oh, my son, Jesus, one more ray of light over my lips so that I may speak only the truth, the pure truth. With the sole purpose of knowing whether it is really you or rather an illusion from the enemy. Now, in the first four volumes, Louisa continuously tries to discern absolutely whether what's happening to her is absolutely from God or absolutely from the enemy. Now, the church is very, very slow to come to the conclusion that something is purely supernatural. Very, very slow. She'll come to any conclusion rather than that because she needs to be sure that if she accepts somebody as a saint or a mystic, that the rest of us can trust that discernment. Whereas if she jumped to that conclusion too quickly, then we wouldn't be half as sure. Okay. So she will continue this discernment as to whether it's right or not. Jesus, she said, how poor in light I see myself in those arms of yours. Now, here she is. She's describing herself in the arms of Jesus. That means in union with him. And if you're living in union with God, therefore you're perceiving something of the holiness and the purity of God, you will see sin much more than anybody else. The saints were the only ones who were able to confess sin. The rest of us think we're grand, you know. Or we say, I lost my temper, but my husband made me do it. So I'm grand, it's my husband, you know. But the saints are the ones who are able to say, I did it. And this is the reason why I did it. So if you can ever get to the stage in confession of saying, I did this and this is why I did it, then the priest knows he has somebody on the way to holiness in his hands. He knows he has somebody serious there. So she can see much more clearly than we can. So she can see muddiness where we wouldn't see it. Okay? So when she says, how poor in light I am, she's saying, I need continuous enlightenment. Now, that's something that you and I need to ask God for every single day. I need enlightenment. I need an increase of light. Okay? Now, you will find as you go through these volumes that the light that is described here is actually the divine will. Okay, God is light, 1 John 1:5. In him there is no darkness.
Is that the same as wisdom? When we ask for wisdom, or is it different?
It's a different aspect of God. Okay. Yeah, light is the very essence of God, because God is light. That's 1 John 1:5. Yeah. We say that wisdom is one of the attributes of God.
Okay.
Yeah. Whereas the light is him. So she says, oh, please content me. You who love me so much, continue to send me light. That's asking for the enlightenment. Oh, my son, my beautiful one, I want to enter right into the center that I may be submerged completely in this most pure light. So she's asking for this thing that we're going to define later on as being fused, that you and me and I and you completely one. Okay, so she's asking for that right at the very beginning. She already has this experience, but she's being asked to write down the stages of getting to this. Oh, divine Son, let this light precede me, follow me, surround me everywhere and penetrate into every intimate hiding place of my interior, that my terrestrial being may be consumed and you may transform it completely, absolutely, in your divine being. So beside that, I always put Romans 8, 37 to 39. That's the union with God. The other completely unique thing about Louisa is that she takes not one step without our Blessed Lady. And it's only when you get to the higher volumes that Jesus will explain that Louisa has to walk in the footsteps of Our Lady, because Louisa is the first person after Our Blessed Lady to walk in the gift of the divine will. So there's a very close relationship between Louisa and Our Blessed Lady. Won't give it to you now. We're only introducing the subject. That would take me off on a tangent completely, because that's a major topic. But here in the very beginning, you're just being introduced to everything, you know. So, Most Holy Virgin, lovable Mother, come to my aid. Obtain from me, from your sweet Jesus and mine, grace and strength in order to do this obedience. Saint Joseph, my dear protector, assist me in this circumstance of mine. Archangel Saint Michael, defend me from the infernal enemy who put so many obstacles in my mind as to make me fail in this obedience. Now, what most people don't see there is the obstacles that are put in your mind. We see obstacles that are put in front of us. You know, if there's a stone put in front of you and you trip, we see the stone. We very often don't see the obstacles that are put in our mind. So beside that, I want you to put 2 Corinthians 10:5. Where St. Paul says that every thought must be captured and given to Christ. Every single one. Now, if you think that's easy, you haven't tried it. So right from the very beginning, and we're only on the second page, there's huge challenge here for anybody who wants to take it seriously. Archangel Saint Raphael and you, my guardian angel, come to assist me and accompany me and to direct my hand that I may write nothing but the truth. Now, this is only her prayer before she starts. That everything may be for the honour and glory of God. That's the whole purpose of walking in the divine will, to give glory to God. You were told it in the Penny Catechism, if you remember it, do you? We were made to know, love, and serve God, you know. And what does the rest of it say?
Be happy with him forever.
Be happy with him forever. So the knowing is the union. Mm-hmm. Loving is the response. Serving is giving him glory. Now, all of that's going to come up in this. That little Penny Catechism was worth gold. And it's terrible that they're not using it now. So everything would be for the glory and honour of God. And to me, only the confusion. Never mind that bit, she's just trying to be humble there. O my spouse, come to my help. In considering the many graces that you've given my soul, I feel horrified and frightened, all full of confusion and shame, and seeing myself so bad. Now, the problem with these writings is that they're translated from the Italian. Now, the book you have, the translation's a bit better than the translation I have, but I can't teach you from the book because I know this one off by heart. Okay. And Luisa didn't speak Italian as we know it today. She spoke a variation of Italian, like St. Bernadette of Lourdes never spoke French as we knew it today. She spoke a kind of a patois. And so when Our Lady said in French that she was the Immaculate Conception, Bernadette could only repeat it. She didn't know what Our Lady was saying. The translators of these writings have had to go from Louise's dialect into ordinary Italian and from ordinary Italian into English. Now, the problem with translating from Italian into English is that they put the verbs, the adverbs and the nouns in different places to us. And so, as far as we're concerned, the sentence is scrambled. That's the only reason why people find this message difficult. And so to unscramble it, you've just got to put the words back in the right place. Like, for example, you'll read, one is the sun. And you say, what in the name of God is that? Mm-hmm. Whereas in English, we would say, the sun is one entity. Or the sun is one star. It's not multiple. And if I say the sun is one star, it's not multiple, you have the message. But if I say one is the sun, you say, what on earth is she talking about? And the problem is the translation. The problem isn't the message. So when Louisa says she's so bad, she uses the word cativa in her language. And cativa is actually translated as, you naughty little thing. Do you know what I mean? That is if we gave it a correct translation into English. But they haven't done that here. And she says, I'm so bad. And what she's saying is, by comparison with your holiness, I'm nothing. Well, if you go to Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 to 10, where Isaiah saw the glory of God in the temple. Do you remember? And what was his immediate reaction? He said, oh, if this is what God is like, he said, I'm a man of unclean lips and I belong to a people of unclean lips. That means I'm looking at all this holiness. I'm bad. That's what Louisa is saying. So it's not bad as in we use the term. Does that make sense? And if you just get the translation of volume 1, you'll run through the rest of it. So she says, she said, not requiting your graces. That means that I'm not responding at the level that I should be responding to your graces. But my lovable and sweet Jesus, forgive me. Do not withdraw from me, but continue to pour your grace into me that you may make me the triumph of your mercy. Now, that's exactly what he does. She asks him to make her the triumph of his mercy, and he actually does it. Beside that, I want you to put Ephesians 2:10. You are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. And she was certainly a work of art, I'll tell you. Ephesians 2:10. Yeah. And also put Philippians 1:6. The work I have begun in you, I will complete. And the Lord completes his work in the most extraordinary way in Louisa. So then she begins and she says, with the novena of Holy Christmas, that is the Christmas novena. Okay, if you have volume one, you'll find at the end of it, at the very end of it, that they give you the Christmas novena. Okay, at the very end of the volume, of volume one, they give you the Christmas novena. And so this is the first thing that she actually remembers clearly. Okay, we won't do it now. I'm just telling you that what she's referring to here is at the end of the book. Is that all right? She was 17 years of age. Listen to what she did for Christmas. And it's in time for you and me. She said, with the novena of Holy Christmas, at the age of 17, I prepared myself for the feast of Most Holy Christmas by practicing various acts of virtue and mortification. What do? We shop until we drop. Then we go partying. Yeah. And then we go eating and drinking and binging and all the rest of it. And Christmas Day is only barely over and they're lined in the streets waiting in the rain for the shops to open. So it's an orgy of buying and selling followed by an orgy of eating and drinking followed by an orgy of buying and selling. It's nothing whatever to do with Christ. Nothing whatever. Listen to how this woman, she was 17, truly a teenager. She said, first of all, she prepared with various acts of virtue and mortification, that's your self-denial, and especially by honouring the 9 months that Jesus spent in the maternal womb with 9 hours of meditation every day. I take it you haven't matched her.
No.
Okay. She did it each day, 9 hours. Now, if you were God, you'd respond to that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So did she get an enormous amount of insight? Absolutely. Sure, God probably said, oh, my birthdays have come. Do you get there? Someone is actually paying attention. Someone is actually preparing for the incarnation. Imagine. And we've got people who won't even go to Mass on Christmas Day. Okay. And so I have a comment, and I wrote some commentary just for myself. I say, if there's a God in heaven, he'll respond to that. She's probably the only one in history that did it. Do you know what I mean? And then she gives you an example of what she did. For example, during 1 hour, with my thought, I brought myself to paradise and I imagined the Most Holy Trinity, the Father sending his Son upon the earth, the Son promptly obeying the Father. Notice she's underlying the obedience. Do you see it? And the Holy Spirit consenting, the three persons, one will. Now, throughout her writings and in these hours of the Passion, which some of you have, she emphasises absolutely the obedience of the Son to the Father. My mind was confused in contemplating a mystery so great, a love so reciprocal, so equal, so strong among themselves and towards us. That's humanity. And then the ingratitude of humanity and especially my own. I would have remained there not for 1 hour, but for the whole day. But an interior voice told me, an interior voice, you're talking about locution, okay, told me, enough, come and see the other great excesses of my love. And then he begins to unfold for her the mysteries that he experienced in his mother's womb. It's all completely new. It's totally amazing. Then my mind brought itself into the maternal womb, and remain stupefied in considering a God so great in heaven, but now so annihilated on earth. Philippians 2, 6 to 10. He left his glory behind. Remember, became one of us, even accepting death on a cross. But she will tell you that he experienced the Passion in the womb, a totally new revelation to the human race. So he was restricted, constrained, as to be unable to move and almost even to breathe. The interior voice said to me, do you see how much that I have loved you? That the you is not just you individually, but you, human race. Please make me a little space in your heart. Remove everything that's not mine. Now, everything that's not his is self-will. Just write it down. You're going to need, this is all the instruction you get at the beginning. The thing we have to remove is self-will. So that you will give me more freedom to move and to breathe. My heart was consumed. I asked for his forgiveness. I promised to be completely his own. I poured myself out in crying. That's in really repentance. And I say this to my confusion. I'd go back to my usual defects. I presume you've never done that. You can have a wonderful time of prayer early in the morning, and 11 o'clock you're back to your usual self, you know what I mean? That's the problem, why we have a huge struggle in coming to God. Oh, Jesus, how good you have been to this miserable sinner, she says. So in this way, so that's the first point she made. So the second point is, I would spend the second hour of the day and so forth with all the rest. I would be annoying if I told them all. Now, initially, she doesn't want to tell it. She doesn't want to say what she did. By the end of volume one, her priest superior has put her under obedience to tell the whole thing. So we now have a tiny booklet of her Christmas novena, which we try to do at Christmas time. But most of us don't spend 9 hours a day on it.
She's in bed, isn't she? She's in
England. No. Oh, not at 17. Oh, God, no. Oh, no, we'll have to go. There'll be quite a struggle. Okay. You'll be into volume 2 and 3 for that. Yeah. Oh, no, she's in the whole of her health. And she's living at home. She's living with her family, a middle-class family. They actually have a housekeeper and so on. So she's having a life that's not very challenging. It's only after a while they begin to realise the extraordinary life she's living in her room. And she said, I would do this sometimes kneeling and sometimes when I was impeded by my family, also while working. In fact, the work that she did was mostly crochet, that kind of stuff. In fact, the interior voice gave me no respite and no peace. We'll have more of that. If I did not do what it wanted. Now, it is actually the divine will. If you put DW there, divine will. Therefore, work was not a hindrance for me into doing what I had to do. In this way, I spent the days of the novena, and when the eve came, I felt ignited more than ever with unusual fervour. I was alone in my room, and all of a sudden, baby Jesus came before me, all beautiful, yes, but shivering in the act of wanting to hug me. I stood up, this kid is 17, and I rang to hug him. But in the act of squeezing him, he disappeared from me. And this occurred as many as 3 times. So something completely extraordinary is beginning. And that is that Jesus would visit her, three-dimensional, as I can see you, every single day. Some people live their entire lives and are canonized saints without having seen him at all. One of them is Thérèse of Lisieux. Never saw him. Okay, so what's going to happen to Louisa is completely off the Richter scale in terms of sanctity. So this is just the initial part of it. I remained so moved and ignited. Now, she means ignited in love and fervour that I cannot explain it. But then after some time, I didn't take it much into account. That's a scream. Do you know she never told anybody that Jesus came to visit her in her room? Would you tell somebody if you had a vision? I didn't tell anyone, she said. And from that time, I would fall into my usual defects. However, the interior voice never left me again. Now, beside that, I want you to put Deuteronomy 32:15. The Lord alone was her guide. Deuteronomy 32:15. The Lord alone was her guide. In everything it, that's the divine will, and it's this interior voice, reprimanded me, corrected me, encouraged me. In other words, she's being personally taught and guided. In a word, the Lord acted with me like a good father whose child tries to deviate from the right path, and he uses all diligence and care to bring him back so as to make of him his honour, glory and crown. Now, beside that, I want you to put Hebrews 12, verses 1 to 10, in which the author of Hebrews is telling you the same thing. But, O Lord, how ungrateful I have been to you. Now, we move on to the next point that she wants to make. And put a little heading over it if you want to put it, stripping. And this is an absolutely essential part of growing in holiness. If the Lord hasn't done any stripping with you, and hasn't asked you to be detached from anything, get worried and make sure you get on his mobile number quick. So from the beginning, the Divine Master began to strip my heart of all creatures. That means attachment to human beings. Now, this is going to be radical for her. You see, you have to be free enough to actually love God. Let me come back into the marriage example. If two young people get married and the husband or the wife is so attached to their family that they keep on running back to their family, then this marriage will never get off the ground, will it? You have to leave father and mother. That's stripping, to cleave to the husband or wife. So the new marriage can't happen if there isn't some kind of a break with the old. So in order for us to truly form a relationship with God that's going to be stable and grow, then we have to have detachment from creatures. And through an interior voice, this is all interior locution, he would tell me, I'm all that is beautiful and deserves to be loved. That is God. But it's Jesus' voice that's speaking. See, if you do not remove this little world that surrounds you, that is thoughts of creatures, imaginations. Now, I've given retreats and spiritual direction since 1980. And I've come across many, many times people would think you are completely irrational if you tell them they have to take control of their thoughts. They say, no, that's the inside of me. That's my private domain. Do you know what I mean? You can talk what you like on the outside. But if your thoughts are not given over to Christ, you aren't either.
The mind of Christ.
You have to have the mind of Christ. But the book of Proverbs will tell you, as a man thinketh, so is he. So if I'm sitting quietly in my house, glorifying myself and making myself out to be the hero of all my interior cinema, then I'm simply worshipping Francis. I'm not worshipping anybody else. Does that make sense? The great image of today is the selfie. And look at the way they stand when they're taking it. Self-glorification. It's very sad. It's actually very, very sad because it's accepted as normal. So self-glorification has to go. That's one of the idols. Nowadays, the idol is yourself. Isn't that frightening? In the past, in generations, it used to be things outside of yourself. Now it's yourself. So you have to go into battle with your own thoughts. Again, that's your 2 Corinthians 10:5. Keep writing it down each time in case you forget. That's 2 Corinthians 10:5. Your own imaginations, you've got to be very careful. You've got to take control of them. Because if you don't do this, he says, I cannot enter your heart. It's that simple. There's no room. Have you ever tried to talk to somebody and you knew you weren't being received? Mm-hmm. Their head was occupied. Mm-hmm. You try to get through to a person and you realize there's a closed door there. The heart is closed to whatever it is you're presenting. Well, that's what Jesus is saying. That many people come to him even in prayer and they don't realize their heart is actually closed to God. And so it is painful for us to have to open up to the realization that this has got to happen. He's got to somehow get me to see that I'm glorifying myself and that he's got to get me to put that idol aside and to put God there. Because otherwise I can't grow in union with God. Do you see why I told you need to come back to volume one? Because if we don't have these foundations in, forget about it, you can read as much as you like of the higher volumes, but the foundations are missing. Look at this. The murmuring of your mind is a hindrance. Now, St. Paul talks about the mind and its murmuring as well. Because you know you can be given out about somebody else in your mind. Yeah, your mind's occupied. It's not occupied with loving the neighbour either. The murmuring of your mind is a hindrance to letting you hear my voice more clearly. Now, many people have said to me, even in the Charismatic Renewal days, I don't hear the voice of God. I said, well, is there enough room in your head? Is there enough room in your ears? Are you actually occupied? And then they throw me out. You know, I was a baddie. I said, no, 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 the problem's inside of you. God is the same with absolutely everybody. So if you free up the telephone line, he will talk to you. So it's the murmuring of your own mind that blocks you hearing my voice more clearly. It blocks me from pouring my graces to truly enamouring you of me. Now, what the Lord is after, I'm going to give you another text that you're going to hear over and over and over and over again here. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 10. This is absolutely central to the first four volumes. Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. Not a bit of it. All your soul. Not a bit of it. All your mind. That's what we're talking about here. And all your spirit. You see, people love God with a little bit of their heart and a little bit of their mind, and but they keep the rest for themselves. So you'll never become a saint, ever. You don't love enough. So he will do what he can to help you to let go of these hindrances so that the union can actually happen. So promise me that you will be all mine. That's the all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. And I myself will put my hand to the work. That's your Philippians 1:6. He will begin a work which he will finish. That's Philippians 1:6. So, you are right that you can do nothing. Do you remember the text? I gave it to you a minute ago. I gave it. Yeah. What's the reference? John 15:5. You're going to get used to some of these because you're going to hear them over and over again. You're right that you can do nothing. He's quoting John 15:5 there. Now, in these writings, Jesus very often quotes the scriptures, but he doesn't say, I am quoting scripture. But why? Because he's the word. He just simply says it. Do not fear. I will do everything. Give me your will. It is enough for me. Now, did you get those little booklets of Tony Hickey with the CDs?
Yes.
Yes. All of you?
No.
No. Some of you? Okay, so and some of you haven't yet. Because in it, Tony will explain to you that Jesus says, if you want to live at this divine level, at the level of the gift, I will do it for you. You can't do it. He has to do it, but we have to ask him. Each time, we've got to ask him, Lord, I want to do this with your will. Lord, I want to assist at Mass with your will. I want to say this rosary with your will. And the more you do with his will, he said, he will actually divinize your actions. But you've got to ask. You've got to want it. So he says, you've got to give me your will. That's the issue. Not my will, but thine be done. And he said, that's enough. But he will explain as we go along in these volumes that us giving our will to him is the greatest sacrifice we can possibly do. And he calls it absolute heroism, because he knows how difficult it is for us to give our will. So Louisa said that these dialogues and these things would happen mostly during communion. Why would it happen during communion? Because Jesus is personally present. Oh, he's personally present. So I would promise him to be all his own, and I would ask his forgiveness. Now, you'll find in the early stages of this getting into the divine will, there's an awful lot of repentance. Ferocious amount of repentance. And if there isn't, then you're not actually getting the illumination that you should be getting. So I'd ask his forgiveness for up to that point I had not done so. I would say to him that I truly wanted to love him, and I prayed him never to leave me alone. And the voice would continue, no, no, I will be together with you, observing all of your actions, movements and desires. Now that corresponds to Psalm 139. You know my thoughts before I think them, my words before I say them, and so on. So we're now going to get a very good illustration of Deuteronomy 32:15, which is the Lord alone was her guide. So I would feel him upon me for the whole day. He reprimanded me in everything. For example, if I let myself be carried away in conversing a little bit too much with my family. Now all she's doing is talking to her family. Even of indifferent things which were not necessary, the interior voice would say to me, these discourses fill your mind with things that do not belong to me. They surround your heart with dust. Look at that. Now, you need to know something about speech. And if you go to the book of Proverbs, you will find 50 proverbs on the tongue alone. 50. And one of them says, there's never a flow of words without a fault. Oh, boys, no wonder from the earliest times in the church people took vows of silence and they went out into the desert to live in silence to try and see was there any possibility that they could actually get to the place of union with God. That was why the monks went out into the desert. Mm-hmm. Never a flow of word without a fault. And there's 50 proverbs. I won't give you the others. They're dotted all over the first 20 chapters of the book of Proverbs. So he says, even in these indifferent conversations, there's dust. In other words, there's stuff you've got to get rid of. Because you know if you're driving, the dust on the windscreen does actually make a difference, doesn't it? Yeah, you have to get rid of it. Such as to make my grace feel weak in you. You find that interesting? No longer alive, that is active. All right. Now, Jesus is demanding a very quick growth from this young lady. He's putting her through a crash course of spirituality so that he can get her by the age of 23 to a place that no other saint has got to. With you and me, he actually goes a bit more slowly. He's not taking it to the same place as her. It's very unlikely you'll get these three divine marriages. Very unlikely. If you get one of them, you're very lucky. So he's bringing her through this crash course, and that's why he's very, very demanding. He wants to get this behind him. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit like in the ancient world, the teachers used to be very hard on the pupils. They had to learn so much in a very short time, and then they were adults by the age of 12. So, oh, please, he said, imitate me when I was in the house of Nazareth. My mind was occupied with nothing but the glory of the Father and the salvation of souls. Now, he's not going to let her have what we call normal life. He's not going to let her have it because he has a huge mission to give to her. And so he needs her to drop what we would call normal life. It's going to be a huge crisis for her and her family initially. Can you imagine being the parent of a 17-year-old who's spending 9 hours a day in prayer in her room? Would you suspect it was prayer? No, you would not. You'd only suspect that there was something radically wrong, which the parents did. Okay, and so she's going to have real trouble with the parents. So he says, my mind was considered concentrated only on the glory of God. My mouth uttered nothing but holy discourses. With my words, I tried to repair for the offences against the Father, to dart through hearts and to draw them to my love, and primarily my mother and Saint Joseph. In a word, everything called upon God, everything was done for God. I want you to underline the little word everything. And everything referred to him. So he's telling her, you've got to be like me in everything. I was completely committed to the glory of God and the salvation of souls. And that's where he's bringing Louisa to an absolutely extraordinary commitment that you and I are not actually called to at the same level. So in these early volumes, one of the exercises we have to do is distinguish what God asked of Louisa and what he's asking of us. That's because you have a different vocation. And you have a vocation to marriage or single life or whatever, and you have whatever mission that's been given to you, and you must fulfil that. You absolutely must fulfil it. Her mission is going to be sitting in a bed for 64 years. I would have gone off my head in a week. I don't know about you. And so what was being asked of her was completely unique and unrepeatable. Is that all right? So since he has asked her this, in the next paragraph, he's going to start cleansing the affections. Now, don't forget that Louisa is an Italian. And if you remember she's an Italian, you're going to understand one aspect of this writing. Italians are very emotional. Have you ever met any? They're very talkative. Have you ever met them? I remember trying to get a group of Italians to do a silent retreat and they roared with laughter at the idea. And so I gave them one retreat to introduce them to silence, and they were all whispering all the time. And they said, oh, but we're silent. I said, no, shut, you're talking all the time. But when I got them to do an actual silent retreat, it was total transformation for them. And once they got into the real silence, you know what they did? I had them for Holy Week. And from Holy Thursday to Easter Sunday, they never left the chapel. They stayed there praying, fasting all the time, took it in turns all the time, all the time, all the time. Very few of them went to bed. So that when you get an Italian to actually give the whole thing, they actually do. Whereas the Irish people would think about it and then decide, no, I'm not actually free that weekend. And so the Lord is going to take this very emotional, very talkative person into total silence and into absolute gift. So you have to know that since she's Italian, that this is a huge, huge, huge thing. It'd be huge for us, 10 times bigger for them. So she said, I remained all confused. I tried to be alone as much as I could. I confessed to him my weakness and I asked for his help and grace to be able to do what he wanted, because by myself I could do nothing but evil. What's the text? I could do nothing but... What's the text? Come on, you have to know. I've given it to you twice already. John 15:5, I can do nothing without him. Would you put John 15:5 beside it? I always make people put it on the actual text, then you'll remember. I could do nothing but evil. If during the day my mind was occupied with thinking about people I loved, he would immediately reprimand me, telling, is this the way you love me? What is he looking for? Deuteronomy 6:4-10, all your mind, all your heart, all your soul. He's demanding the real thing from her. Who has ever loved you like me? See, if you do not stop it, he said, I'll leave you. Now, one of the marvelous things about these writings, which I personally appreciate hugely, is that the relationship between Jesus and Louisa is real. It's not up there, mystical, I say prayers and somehow he answers them. He acts like a real male and she acts like a real female. And that's why he says to her, if you don't stop that, I'm gone. And so I'll give it to you in ordinary language so that you'll actually hear the incredible thing that this is real. And in order to get the rest of us to get into a real relationship with the Lord, you have to present it. So if you just read on and read on and don't realise that you're being told you can have a real relationship with him as well. You know, the Lord said to a holy person once, the holy person was giving out and he said, give out to me, not to other people. He said, give out to me and I can respond to you. Because what he was saying was, communicate with me. Don't be just giving out. We just give out, don't we? Don't be just giving out. Say it to me. He doesn't mind if you fight with him, because you're actually relating to him if you do. And what he wants is that this, we will enter into this very real personal relationship. And then what will happen is that you will discover that the uniqueness of your person will come out, because he'll draw it out. And this is what you find in these writings. The uniqueness of Louisa's person actually comes out. It's fantastic. So he says, if you don't stop it, this is the man talking to the woman, I'll leave you. And she said, sometimes I would receive such and so many reproaches that I would do nothing but cry. And don't forget, she's 17. So the crying is tolerated at 17. It's not tolerated when she gets a bit older. And so she's having a very painful move away from everything she considers normal to a life that she doesn't know. She's been guided into a life she doesn't know. Now, that's like Abraham leaving Ur of the Chaldees, going to a country he doesn't know. It's a journey into the unknown. Very difficult. For some reason, I put Matthew 10:37 beside that. So one morning in particular, after communion, he gave me a light. Now, a light means infused knowledge. It's directly into the intellect. So clear about the great love that he had for me and about the fickleness and inconstancy of creatures. Now, he's talking about human beings, the way a human being can love you and then walk away from you. We're fickle and inconstant, whereas he is totally constant all the time. If he says, I love you, it's eternal. that my heart was so convinced as to be incapable from that time on loving anyone. Now, when she says loving anyone, she's talking about being attached to them. Because when you actually come to love God, you will love your relatives in the correct way, but you will love them in a godly way, not in the I'm attached to you and I need you stuff. That kind of stuff is freed. So this detachment is learning how to love people correctly, loving them in their own shoes, for their own reasons, not for anything that you can get from them or anything else. So the detachment is getting relationships into right order. Now, if you look at the very beginning of your book, you'll see that this is all the call of the creature to return to the order, the place, and the purpose for which they were created by God. And so the very first thing is the Lord tries to put our relationships in order. He tries to put our emotions in order. He tries to put our thinking in order. He tries to put our relationship with him in order, because otherwise we're not on the right journey. Everything's got to be put in order. So if you get really sincere about this, you will find that he'll correct you as well. Now, he may not correct you directly as he did with Louisa, but what he'll do is he'll use creatures to say to you, you're a fine one. You're telling us that you're growing in holiness. Look the way you're behaving now. And he'll use people all around you to correct you. It's fascinating. So he taught me how to love people without detaching myself from him. That's the important bit. That is, by looking at the people as images of God. In other words, you take a different view of a person. You're not looking at them in the way that many people do. You know, you're my relative and there's these connections and there's this history and blah, blah, blah. No, none of that. You're looking at them as someone that God created. And whether they're related to you or not, you see them in their own shoes, in their own vocation, and you can begin loving them in a completely new way. Completely new. It's the most wonderful thing when you see families beginning to move into this new relationship of actually loving one another as God loves them, because then the Lord can do great things. So when she begins her intercession for human beings, she will often say to Jesus, but they are your images. You can't do that chastisement. They're your images. You've got to do something else. And she will use that all the time. So Romans 8, St. Paul will tell you that we are in the image of God. I forget the verse, Romans 8, 29 or something like that. Sorry?
His artwork or works of art?
No, no, Romans 8. Okay. His artwork is Ephesians 2:10. Romans 8. It's around verse 31, I think. So we look at people now as images of God in such a way that if I received any good from them, instead of creatures, just put them, I was to think that God alone was the prime author of that good and that he used that person in order to send it to me. Now, most of us don't think that way. Let me give you an example, because I'm dealing with somebody that the Lord has blessed in the most extraordinary way, and it's a man, and I promised him that I would give him a book. And then I said to the Lord, I have to find this book now, now that I promised it. And I went to a meeting a week later, and a person handed me the book as a gift. So when I met this man again, I said to him, this gift is from the Lord through me, through that person, through me to you. I said, I didn't pay a penny for it. I asked the one you loved. And he said, oh, that figures. I said, he spoils you rotten. And he said, yeah, he does. And you see, the point is the Lord will spoil you if you really give yourself to him. He'll start off with little things until you begin to recognize he does this and he does that and he does the other. And then he'll raise the game until he'll do bigger things for you and bigger things. Then finally, you might say to him, Lord, will you heal such and such a person? And he'll say, surprising you asked. Because it's the same Lord. But you're actually letting him use you as a channel, just as that tap is merely a channel to let water into this house. You don't glorify the tap, do you?
No.
Yeah, that's what it's supposed to do. And so we're supposed to be channels of the Lord to others as well. So you, things like this will begin to be normal after a while.
It affects us as it flows through us, doesn't it?
So God alone is the prime author, but he moves people along the chain. It's really fantastic. And you'll discover that he works at both ends of the line at the same time. It's really fantastic. If then I received mortifications, I was to look at them as instruments in the hands of God for my sanctification. So when people would go against you and that kind of thing, to accept that from God as well, so that you never turn around and blame somebody. So my heart would not stay huffy with my neighbour. Mm. You see, if we blame the neighbour, that's the huffiness towards the neighbour. Mm. Now that huffiness means that your emotions are not in the right place in your relationship with God. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In this way, it happened that I would look at all people in God. Now, that is the issue. Mm-hmm. It's to see them in a different light. That is the issue. Whatever defect I might see in them, I'd never lose esteem for them. Because at the same time, the Lord is showing you your own defects. If they mocked me, I felt obliged, thinking that they were allowing me to make more gains for my soul. If they praised me, I received these praises with contempt, saying, today this, tomorrow they may say something else. Now you'll come across this again. There's two great imposters in life. Even the atheistic philosophers say it. It isn't just Christ that says it, and it isn't just me, and it isn't just Louisa. There's two great imposters in life. One is praise and the other is blame. And the reason why they're called the great imposters in life is that people can praise you for 101 reasons, and they may not all be good. They may be praising you to get something out of you. So they're buttering you up to get something out of you. So that praise is worthless. They can also blame you for 101 reasons. And so what the Lord is teaching Louisa is that you dismiss praise and blame. Just dismiss them. I remember at a talk on psychology at one stage, the lecturer said, if somebody blames you, divided by 100, and you may get a kernel of truth, you may. Because what the person very often is doing is just giving an outlet to their emotions, that's all. You never do this. You always do that. Now, the never and the always are always wrong. But that's what human beings do when they're upset. So you're just getting a blast of emotion, and it's much better to just dismiss it. Mm-hmm. And try not to blame them or anything else. Just go free from it if you can. That's like saying, there's a heavy shower outside, get in into the house quick. Just get out of it. And so, considering their inconstancy, that's the inconstancy of human beings. They praise you one minute, they blame you the next. In sum, my heart acquired such freedom. That is the issue. That's what the Lord wants, that I cannot explain it. So when the Lord tells you not to accept the praise or the blame and to try and get all the imbalance out of your being, you reach this incredible freedom. Now, one of the major mountain peaks in the spiritual life is personal freedom. Personal emotional freedom. That is one of them. Because unless we reach this personal emotional freedom, we're not free enough to actually serve God. Now notice Louise is giving you all this as an introduction. In other words, the divine will spirituality is not a beginner's spirituality. It's the highest spirituality. So it's already presumed that you know God. It's already you presumed that you're on the road. It's already presumed that you are trying to live a spiritual life. And here we're just filling in the dots to make sure that you haven't left that out. You haven't left that out. That's why I call volumes 1-4 the foundation stones. So you won't have got 20 pages into this when you realise, no, this is the University of Spirituality. Mm. This is not the primary school or the secondary school. This is the highest spirituality. It's called the New and Divine Holiness. So, acquired great freedom. That's Philippians 4:4. Galatians 3:1 is that the Lord made you free, would you stay in your freedom? Okay. I think it's Galatians 3:1. So when the divine master freed me from the external word, then he put his hand to purify my interior. So now he has set her free on the outside. He wants to give her an extraordinary freedom on the inside. And he said to her, now we are alone. Now you have to know, if you go back in history, that monks have gone out into the desert for centuries. And it's taken them years and years and years to reach the point of being alone with the alone. Have you heard that expression before? Alone with the alone is called what? There's one word for it.
Spiritual intercourse.
No. No. Think about it. There's one word for it. No. Think about it. Think about it, because I don't want to waste time on this thing. Now we are alone. It's called solitude. Solitude is a million miles away from loneliness. Loneliness means you miss somebody. You actually need somebody. That's why you're lonely. Solitude is that you miss nothing. You are alone with the alone. And when you reach this solitude, you actually reach the heart of the universe. And you can touch heaven very easily. That's why the monks went out into the desert, is to find this solitude. And that's what Jesus is saying to her. So write the word solitude beside it, will you? Alone with the alone is solitude. S-O-L-I-T-U-D-E. So he said, there's nobody left to disturb us. Aren't you happier now than before when you had to content so many people? Actually, to reach solitude is the happiest place on earth. Many people get moments of solitude when they go up a mountain and have a couple of hours to themselves, just on a mountain all by themselves, or sit by the sea, or walk in a forest or something. What they don't know they're looking for is solitude, but they're actually tasting a little bit of it and love it. You see, it's easier to content one alone. You must consider as if you and I were alone in the world. Now, that's only for Louisa. You're not expected to do that because you have your family and your job and your everything. Promise me that you will be faithful and I will pour so many graces into you that you yourself will be amazed. Yeah, Louisa couldn't imagine the amount of grace he's going to give to her. So what he's going to do is begin to tell her something of his demands. He continued, I've made great designs upon you as long as you correspond with me, is the way my book says it. We would say respond, so long as you respond. I want to make you a perfect image of me. Do you see it there? That's the issue, that Louisa is to be a perfect image of Jesus. Now, he is only God and man. And to get somebody who's only 17 years of age and has got to grow hugely in spirituality to be a perfect image of him is just, it's beyond miracle. It's absolutely beyond miracle. So Romans 8:19, we are to be in his image, and also verses 32 to 39. So he said, I want you to be a perfect image of me from the moment I was born up to my death. That includes the crucifixion. It's completely unique. I myself will teach you little by little how to do it. So I'll just do one more section with you and then we'll stop. So if you want to put a heading for the next section, put humility is the foundation stone. You get absolutely nowhere with God if there's no humility. Forget about it, you get nowhere. And it happened in this way. Every morning after communion, he would tell me what I was supposed to do during the day. I will say everything briefly because after so much time, 20 years, it's impossible to say everything. I don't remember for sure, but it seems to me that he told me the first thing which was necessary in order to purify the interior of my heart was the annihilation of myself. That is humility. Now, she's going to use the expression the annihilation of myself hundreds of times, you just have to know it's humility. So without humility, you get nowhere with the Lord and you get nowhere in the divine will. But when you get up to the higher volumes, he will tell you that humility isn't enough. Now, I have a little old book in there and it gives you 13 degrees of humility. I didn't get past the third one, even reading it. I said, no, I can't handle this at all. But Jesus has solved the problem completely for us in the divine will. He gets you into a place of nothingness where you just set yourself aside completely. And he said, when you get in there in your nothingness, he says, the creator is completely free to work miracles. Because he said, I created everything out of nothing. And if I can just get somebody to go back into that nothingness, he said, I'm completely free. So you go way beyond humility. So this humility here is only an introduction, is that all right? But you see, you can't get anywhere with God. The people who serve Satan, you'll recognize them. His name is pride and arrogance, and you see it in them as well, pride and arrogance. You'll always recognize the people who are serving God. It's humility and love. They're the two things you recognize are humility and love, at whatever degree they're at. So you'll recognize who's who and in what kingdom they actually live. So the first one is humility, the foundation stone. And he continued, see, so that I may pour my graces into your heart, I really want you to understand that you can do nothing by yourself. Now tell me the reference. John 15:5. Write it down. I told you you're going to meet it over and over and over again. John 15:5 and Philippians 4:13. By myself, I can't do it. With him, I can. I'm very much wary of those souls who attribute what they do to themselves. You see, you're in the wrong kingdom if you say, I'm doing it. Wanting to make of my graces as many thefts, you know, because they can't do it without him. On the other hand, with those who know themselves, now, this is the next step. Self-knowledge is the basis of all growth. You can't grow at all without self-knowledge. And so self-knowledge is utterly essential for the relationship with God. Utterly essential. You know what self-knowledge is, do you? Let me give you an example. Supposing all of us were living in a family and I was one of these creatures that's so touchy you couldn't say boo to a goose to them, you know what I mean? They get offended at the slightest thing and all the rest of it. All of you are suffering from that because I'm so touchy that you can't say anything. The only person in the family who needs the information is me. Does that make sense? So if I get the information that I'm so touchy that I'm making life impossible for everybody else, there's a possibility that I can grow. And all of you will be let off the hook. That's called self-knowledge. Is that important? And one of the genius things of the Catholic Church is that we were given the sacrament of reconciliation, where you're supposed to grow in self-knowledge. And you go back to the Lord all the time. I've discovered this about myself. I've discovered that about myself. And it all gets grace and it gets help and you get guidance and all the rest. It's a genius thing. To help us to grow. So that's the humility is first, self-knowledge is second. I am generous in pouring my graces in torrents with those who know themselves. So knowing very well that they can attribute nothing to themselves, they are grateful to me and they hold it in that esteem which befits it. And they live with the continuous fear that if they don't respond to me, I may take away from them that which I gave. So they realize they can't do it themselves, so they keep clinging to the Lord. It is all the opposite with hearts that reek with pride. I cannot even enter into their hearts, you see? There's no room, because they're so swollen with themselves, and that's their self-love. You remember Our Lady said, he pulls the mighty from their thrones and raises up the lowly. And 1 Peter 5, verses 5 to 9 says, bow down before the power of God now, and he will raise you up. So he says, these miserable ones, the proud and arrogant ones, take my graces into no account, and they go from fall to their ruin. Therefore, on this day, I want you to make continuous acts of humility. In other words, go out of your way to do it. I want you to be like a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes who can move neither foot nor step, hand nor hand to work, but expects everything from its mother. That is complete surrender to God. In the same way, you will stay close to me like a baby, always praying me to assist you and help you, always confessing your nothingness in some, expecting everything from me. Let me give you a tiny example how I was trying to put this into words when I started out this journey many years ago. And I said, Lord, I am poverty. He said, I am plenty. I said, I am sick. He said, I am health. I am poor. He said, I am rich. And whatever I said, he said, I'm the solution. All you need is me. And the importance of acknowledging that I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not the other, is that you realize, he said, that I am everything for you. Now, who is the person in the gospel who said, I am not, I am not, I am not? Gospel of John, chapter 2. I'm not the Messiah. I'm not the Christ, John the Baptist. Yeah. And all the I'm nots of John the Baptist, Jesus was the I am. I am the Messiah. I am the Christ. I am the Lord. I am the Savior. And John the Baptist says, oh, I'm not that. That's him as somebody else.